And everything with cooking, though, that's so cool is it's all about technique. Your taste is your taste, period. You like a lot of salt, you put more salt in it. The technique of how you get to making that bread or that sauce or that creme brulee, whatever it is, you know the technique of how to achieve what your palate desires.
Welcome to Nashville Drummers Podcast, episode 17.
Today's guest is Memphis native and Nashville local Marcus Finney.
Marcus is pretty much a legend at this point. If he were not the nicest dude that we know, he would be the most intimidating dude that we know. He is a beast. He's a crazy drummer and a Grammy winner and also apparently an incredible cook. So there's that.
Yeah, I think it's really cool talking to Marcus much of the episode about the parallels between cooking and preparing meals and dishes and ingredients with that of drumming and preparing for studio sessions and playing live. And I think for not only for people interested in food, but for this episode, I think it's just really valuable to hear different parallels between drumming and different non-drumming hobbies and different activities. I think it'll be hopefully pretty relatable for many of you.
100% agree. This episode is brought to you by, hey, look at that, first time I've ever saying it. I'm so excited to say it. It's brought to you by Music Lab Nashville. Serving the Nashville, Brentwood, and Franklin areas, Music Lab Nashville offers comprehensive hands-on music lessons in contemporary techniques and styles. Students learn from the most qualified instructors in the state-of-the-art practice and performance settings. All ages, all styles, all levels. Visit nashville.musiclab.co to learn more and to sign up for a free trial lesson.
Welcome, Marcus Finney, to the podcast.
Thank you, man. Great to have you.
We've been trying to, like most of our guests, I feel like we've been trying to schedule.
Yeah.
Especially you, though. You've been so busy and same with us, which I guess is a good thing, right?
It is.
It's like, hey, man, a session came up. Or
yeah.
So thank you for making the time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very appreciated.
Yeah. Glad to be here.
My first question for you is, how was that pizza?
The pizza actually tasted good. The only thing I would change is how I prepped the crust. I would probably bake it a little bit before I start layering sauce and stuff on it.
Okay.
To make sure you get the nice crisp bottom.
Okay.
Because, I mean, let's face it. I mean, no matter what you do here in Nashville, it's never going to taste like New York or Italy because the water is just different. And people tend to forget that water is the main source of everything that we cook. And if the water is slightly different, it's going to make everything else taste slightly different.
Mm.
It's just never going to be the same.
Yeah.
So I got the sauce tasting the way I wanted it to taste. So I was happy about the sauce. The toppings I got from Whole Foods, pepperoni and fresh pork sausage, and the cheese, it was like 365 Whole Foods pizza blend cheese. So
yeah,
it was fine. But the crust, yeah, that's the hardest part. Mm. So next Sunday, I'm going to attempt it again and try it, and I'll post.
I'll look forward to seeing it. You ever think of doing sourdough?
I haven't. I like I said today, I'm one of the few times I baked. I don't bake a lot because there's so much error.
Yeah.
Potential error involved. Like if your yeast is off, you know, once it's in the oven, it's too late to fix it.
Yep.
You know, you can't salvage things that you're baking. So it takes a little more concentration. And I should jump into it more. Like croissants are something else I want to try to make.
Yeah.
But it's,
I've heard that's quite the process.
Yeah, it is a process, man.
Yeah. Multiple layers.
Multiple layers, stuff. Cold, put it in the freezer, put it in the fridge for a certain time, take it out, fold, cold butter. In and out.
Yeah. So, wow.
Yeah.
I know nothing about baking.
It's a process, man.
So that was your first go ahead on the pizza?
I've done it before years ago, but like didn't really try anymore just because I was just literally discouraged by the dough.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it had to have been, I think the last time I made it was maybe 10 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Just never tried it again. But after working at this place that I work as a kitchen assistant, been watching them make, and I help in prepping, but the actual customer, they actually cook the food, and I watch whatever chef is on duty at that moment to kind of watch what they do and listen to what they say.
Do you mind sharing what place that is? Is that a restaurant?
Sur La Table. It's not a restaurant. It's a cooking store where they sell different cookware, all clad things, scan pan, stove, Jura coffee. I mean, all of this stuff. And they teach cooking classes there, up to 16 people in the class. And on any given day, there'll be four classes in a day, four different classes. So you'll have things like French baking in one class. Next class may be Italian pasta night.
Oh, that's so
cool.
The
next class may be Brazilian steak night. The next class may be, you know, Thai. You know, so it's like dishes all over the place. And so as a kitchen assistant, I'm helping to prepare for the following class while trying to clean and keep everything neat while that class is going on. So it's fun. It's labor intensive, but I've learned so much. That's the main reason why I started working there, was to kind of low key go to culinary school.
Mm. Oh yeah.
You know, and
getting,
learn.
Literally getting paid to learn this.
Yeah. And the staff, they're great. Made some really cool friends working there. And so it's just a mountain of information that I've been getting. So it's been great.
That's so cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely like a topic I wanted to cover, is just your passion for food and cooking. And do you and your wife go to farmers markets around town?
Not really. I did a little bit during the pandemic. And the downtown farmers market is nice. I've been there a few times. I got a chicken there one time, a farm chicken. And I don't know if it was a particular breed of chicken, but it was very tough and unusually tough.
Yeah.
And I was like, man, I don't know if I like this.
Yeah.
But I did get, very gamey. The main thing I get that are farm to table, it's one of my neighbors across the street, their family sell eggs. So I just get farm fresh eggs from them. And it makes a big difference,
It really does.
Yeah.
If anybody out there has never experienced the difference between store-bought eggs and farm-fresh eggs from your friend or neighbor or whoever, it's a completely different world.
Yeah, and I don't know how much – I'm pretty sure there's some scientific data to substantiate this, but the color of the yolk is usually darker. Almost orange.
Yep.
With farm eggs versus that pale yellow. It's richer tasting, I know that. And yeah, it just tastes better.
It does?
You know.
I mean, so. I guess taste is subjective, but
sure.
I 100% agree.
Yeah.
It tastes noticeably better. The fat quality in the yolk is
it's like the difference in eating potato chips versus Pringles.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Like nobody to this day can tell me what Pringles are.
Trying to connect it back to drumming. I'm thinking of like snare drums, right? Like
snare drums, you know, or heads, or
it's subjective to a point, but it's like, okay, that you're like my first CB, you know, snare versus like, you know, a Pearl or a Dennis Chamber snare.
I still have my CB700 kit.
Are you a CB2?
No kidding.
Yeah, CB700 International. I think I got it when I was 6 or 7 years old.
Did we get the same kit? It like a wine red?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
That's the only 12, thing
12, 13, 16, 22.
Can you tell me what CB stands for?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it stands for crappy best. that's what my friend
before.
My friend Caleb Franklin told me that. He's like, you know what CB stands for, right?
Right. No. Yeah. I still have no idea what it's made of either. Yeah. It's not wood.
Oh. You know, Pearl used to make a lot of those brands.
I didn't.
Yeah, I think CB was one of them.
Wow.
It just wasn't, it didn't have the Pearl name on it.
Yeah, I still have it. For a while, I still used it when I got in town because I didn't have a kit.
Yeah.
You know, except for that one, like high school, coming here, playing gigs around town, jazz. I had a Piccolo Pearl snare that I got when I was in 10th grade that I still have and I still use. It's amazing.
Is it the little bronze one?
No. It's the steel.
Okay.
3.5.
Okay.
Free floater Piccolo. But I used that snare and I had like a Ping Ride playing like, you know, quiet jazz in like a local restaurant, like my freshman year, sophomore year in college. Yeah. And eventually started getting, you know, better gear. So, but yeah, the CB700 is in my attic to this day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, cool. Why don't we kind of jump back? I don't really know. I know you, you know, through Pearl and just through being around town. And I don't really know your whole backstory. I know you know, you're from Memphis and you've been here now for what, over 15 years, 20 years?
No, I've been here since 99.
99. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So you've seen all the change and all the traffic, right?
Yeah. Having made that trek back and forth from Nashville to Murfreesboro mm-hmm. back then, you know, that straight road can get hypnotic.
Yes.
But now with the traffic, it's, I had to go out there last week for rehearsal and I was dreading it because I haven't made that drive in so long. I'm not used to it anymore and I don't want to get used to it.
Yeah.
But it's so much traffic. But having seen the change, I personally kind of welcome it. You know, it has its cons with traffic congestion being the problem. That's a solvable problem, you know, with infrastructure.
Yeah.
But the fact that there are so many people moving here, for me, since it started, you know, I've said over and over that I'm glad that people are moving here in the music industry, particularly because it opens the industry up more.
Yeah, I've always felt that too. I mean, like, from a day to day, it's obviously like it's easy to just say, oh, it sucks, it's so crowded.
Sure.
But I moved here for music and most of us did. And like, we want the city to be vibrant and have an influx of new ideas and new cultures. And
both of those.
Yeah.
Both of those, 100%. Cultural differences, diversity, and musical. And it makes Nashville the diverse city that it always claimed to be.
Right.
You know, is actually following through, whether it wants to or not is irrelevant, but it's following through. And
wait, not that's diverse.
Right. Exactly. So it's, but the music, I mean, we have a jazz club, you know, mm-hmm. that was a big feat, you know, when we got that, it was like, well, that was a big win, I should say. And
do you remember what year that was?
Rudy's opened, was it 2018? Hmm. I believe 17, 18.
Yeah.
Somewhere around in there, I believe.
Wow. Right as I was arriving. That's awesome.
They will correct me on that. I can't remember. But when it opened, it was a big deal. Because prior to that, you know, the closest thing we had was the Nashville Jazz Workshop. But because it was a school, it wasn't a full-time venue. They could only do so much. But it helped to kind of carry us over until Rudy's open. They had other places that would feature, you know, improvisational music, other venues that would, so to speak, allow it, but it wasn't like the source of that venue, like Rudy's is. That was a big win for Nashville. And you know, they've had some really nice people, our acts come through mm-hmm. and play there. And then, of course, we have a larger venue like City Winery. That is a very open venue where they actually kind of, at least at the time, I don't know what the latest is there now, but at the time, there was a gentleman I was working there with who sought to get everything out of the Nashville norm.
Right.
So all things sonically creative, stylistically improvisational, things that are just different. That was like one of his goals. Kind of like how this history of Exit Inn is, if I'm not mistaken. That was their mission as well, to not do country.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But to do everything other than. So, I mean, it's been great watching the change and seeing these different people move here and still moving here. Like, somebody texted me today that, oh man, I'm just moving here, man. Let's grab some coffee. And I'm like, all right, cool. You know, that to me is what it's about. And if anyone is complaining about it, you know, it's just one of those things that you have to like know within yourself. Do I want to do the work? Or did I just want to just sit? Because people are going to call who they are going to call. There's nothing you can do to stop that.
Right.
You know, so if you have someone that consistently calls you, but then someone moves to town, because this happened to me as well back in 99, 2000.
Yeah.
Someone new moves to town, you have a new sound, they start calling you instead of the other person. Mm. Well, if you are no longer getting that call, no point in you getting mad at that other drummer.
Right.
That drummer didn't do anything to you.
Just exists.
It's just like, who are you mad at? The person that called him or the drummer?
Yeah. Don't hit the player, hit the game.
Yeah.
But in this case, don't even hit the game, but adapt. Just if you want to be
adapt,
in the game,
then you have to up your game, you know.
I love that mindset.
Modernize it and like stay with it and, you know, and find a niche, you know.
Yeah.
Try to find one. I mean, there are definitely drummers who have moved to town where, you know, if I were in that same mindset of these other guys, I would cringe, you know, knowing that, you know, at the time when Keith Carlock moved to town or when Nate Smith moved to town and like you know, big influencers of mine, you know, people who I look up to, and people like Paul Mayberry, you know, when I see his posts, I'm like, golly, his sounds are just incredible.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
You know, and there are several other people that have moved here from New York. One of my close friends, Terrence, who lives in Memphis still, out touring with Keith Urban, you know, got that connection from putting in the work, driving back and forth to Nashville to Memphis. Never really committed to move here, but I thought that that was a big win because it's like, no, you shouldn't. I mean, if you can make that connection and keep your roots where you are, why not?
Right.
Other people do that. They live in New York or LA and they come to Nashville to do sessions for country artists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they live other places. So, I mean, it's
as long as you're perceived as being present, you can win. Like that's the whole thing.
Totally.
Here, you must be present to win. And people, they just, I see them around. They're always at, they live here. Give them a call.
Sure. Absolutely, man. So, you know, do your thing and be okay with it. You know?
Yeah, I love that.
So, okay, you said you came here in 99, right?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you've kind of been a part of or at least present for all of the changes. And as you said, like the Rudy's opening up was a big win.
Mm-hmm.
So when you came here initially, because I know your background is not like country music.
Sure. Stuff.
So what was that like for you? Because for me personally, I got to come here when I knew things were kind of cosmopolitan. I'm like, there's a jazz scene there, and there are like metal bands and things like that I can jump into. Because everyone asked me, like, so you're gonna do country music now? No, I don't think so. I don't plan to.
Right.
But you were in it when that's what was going on. What was it? What was in your mind? What was your plan?
So it wasn't a plan for sure. I mean, when I got here, I came for MTSU, for Middle Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I didn't really have, I don't think I really even had an ambition to really stay in Nashville. After I did the Disney Collegiate Band my freshman year out in California, I wanted to go there. But at that time, tuition out of state, undergrad, way up there. So end up coming back. And when I graduated, I went on the road and started working with non-country people. You know, Warren Barfield, I mean, CCM at the time, and then straight from that gig to Donna Summer's gig to Billy Preston to Larry Carlton. So I wasn't doing country, but I thought like, oh man, I could stay here. I'm doing this type of work in Nashville. Mm-hmm. You know, Nashville is the only place where it's known for one genre of music,
right,
intentionally, but it's known for country music, you know, and the other two major music places are not known for one thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so I think it's great, once again, you know, to have seen the evolution of Nashville and the music evolve into what it is. Still has some growth for sure. But I think that with that change, with when people come to Nashville, like you said that people thought that you were going to do country. Mm-hmm. Now, I did do two country tours. I did Lady Antebellum and a guy named Chuck Wicks, and had a blast, you know. But it's one of those where it's like, cool, I'll come in, I play, I meet some new friends who I'm still friends with to this day. Slim Gamble, guitar player, played some shows with him recently, and we stayed in contact. A bunch of people in there. And I think when we started looking at music more as a connectivity thing versus a genre, it kind of helps people's minds being open instead of being so cliquish, you know. Definitely. You'll be at Rudy's and Casey Musgraves will be there, you know, just hanging. You know, it's like you'll have songwriters, incredible songwriters in there just hanging.
Yeah.
You know, and it's having the diverse culture that exists here musically allows for those big writers to come out and be inspired. Jason Eskridge hosted for years. Still hosting Sunday Night Soul.
Yep.
That's an incredible event.
That is an oasis.
Yeah.
When I first moved here and I discovered that, I was like, oh,
yeah,
I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah, man. It's so worth going to check out, man. Yeah. He's always going to have good music.
Yeah.
You know,
every time.
Every single time.
Yep.
And it's just a hang. It's no nonsense. It's just a really good hang.
Was that once a month or is it once a week?
Twice a month. Sunday Night Soul, every second and fourth?
I think so, yeah. I played it a couple times with Janelle Means. So much fun.
Who's another person. I'll be playing with Soul Vibe next Tuesday.
Awesome.
At the Hutton Hotel.
Yeah.
What's the name of the...
The Analog?
The Analog, yeah.
Yeah.
Playing Analog. They're doing a Gap Band tribute.
Yeah, they are.
So
she asked me if I could play a couple songs, and I can't. I'm like, I just can't make it work.
Yeah, yeah.
So I love Janelle. Dave She's Grohl the best. Gap Band tribute?
Not quite.
Have you seen that?
I have not.
Oh, you haven't seen that interview? You know what I'm talking about, right?
I think I do.
Where he talks about how he stole that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Boom,
like, boom. Like, you can't unhear it once you've heard it.
Yeah. I mean, but everybody, there's definitely some conversations to be had within, like, being inspired versus straight ripping.
Yeah.
It's such an ambiguous thing
in
certain ways. But I do appreciate hearing stories like that.
Yeah.
Like Bonham, Moby Dick drum solo, being basically a Max Roach drum solo.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, like, knowing that a lot of those drummers got their ideas from not so popular genres.
Right. They were just loving it, because that's Bonham was like obsessed with all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, I just want to do that, but in this music.
Right, right.
Yeah, I love that. And especially genres that you think would be seemingly opposite to.
Right.
You know,
right.
That's even more surprising.
Yep. So, anyway, that was a big detour. Sorry.
No, we're all about the detours, especially me.
I really like that mindset of, like, not being so bucketed of the genres, but just being open-minded to the community here and the musicians here. And that's what I love about Nashville. That is how it is, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think that's how people are going to be successful with that mindset.
Yeah.
So talk to us, just kind of go back to MTSU. Who'd you study with? And, like, how was your time there? How did that kind of, like, you know, lead to where you are now?
So at MTSU, I studied with Lalo Davila.
Yeah, I was going to.
I studied with him. And I studied a lot of drum set stuff from a guy named Andy Smith.
Yeah.
And,
Andy. And
so those are the two main drum percussion instructors that I studied with. Outside of that, you know, Dana Landry over the jazz department, Don Elico, Eric Applegate. And then I changed my major from music over to recording industry.
Mm-hmm.
So I was under Cosette Collier, Dan Pfeiffer.
What Rich, sort of Rich triggered Barnett. that change for you?
Lalo, man. Like, he had a good sit down talk with me one day, and he was like, man, I think you need to switch your major over, because you don't really want, like, playing Yellow After the Rain was just kind of like,
first
four mallet stuff.
Yeah.
It was just kind of, I mean, and it was good advice. I mean, and it's to segue, I am a big proponent of, if you're a student and you're going to college, if you're in high school and you want to go to college to major in music, my question for you is, what do you want to do with your major? Do you want to teach, or do you want to play?
Mm.
You know? And that's a big crossroads,
that's an heavy
question. Yep. Because colleges don't want to hear my,
right,
you know, my solution. and parents are appreciative of it, because it comes down to, like, ones and zeros to me.
Yeah.
It's like, I have not been asked for my degree for any session or gig that I've ever done.
Right.
Except to teach at a university. That's the only time that piece of paper mattered. And now, did I gain anything from being a music major, or at least a music minor? Yeah. I gained the camaraderie, the, you know, friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, participating in the ensembles. It was great. Reading was a big thing, you know. Could have done that with just private lessons instead of majoring in it. I'm a proponent, personally, if a student is enrolling into a university, you need to, at least, if you're going to be a music major for the sake of making a career, you need to take some kind of entrepreneurship course, because that's
that.
Essentially what you are becoming.
Yes.
Is an entrepreneur. So you need to know business, not music business per se. You need to know, like, plain old business.
Yeah. You are your own small business.
Yes.
At that point.
And you need to know how to negotiate. You need to know what your time is worth, how to value your time, and think about, like, part of my curriculum. I mean, I teach at Belmont, adjunct there, and part of my juries is that you have to basically answer these questions. Because for me, if you've been playing all semester, I've heard you play, part of what you have to play. I do give you some book exercises, some PDF stuff for coordination things. But with that, you have to learn one or two songs a week. So when you come back in the following week, you have to play those songs, but not along with the iPod. You have to play it by yourself, sing the melody and play, because what that's going to do, and you may not know the words, that's fine. But what that's going to do is that you're going to know the form of the song because you know the melody. You're going to know the tempo of the song because you know the melody. And you're not going to overplay because you can't.
Right.
You're too focused on the melody. And now you're going to play in between the spots, which is usually the end of a phrase, play a fill going back in, but you're going to be careful about the fill that you play, you know, based on, does the melody have a pickup going in there? And how are you going to like do both at the same time? So it's kind of threefold with, you know, making them do that and not having that crutch of like playing along with the iPod.
Yeah.
So if I mess up, the iPod got me.
Right. No training wheels.
You have to do it. Right. Yeah. You have to do it on your own. Wow. So once you go through all semester doing those exercises, PDFs, and whatever genre you decide, I make like four or five different syllabi to pick from for world music, Latin, R&B, jazz, technical stuff, if you want to go down that path. But you still have, even in the technical stuff, you still have songs to learn.
Yeah.
You know? And so by the end of the
probably
so
by the end of the semester, I've heard you play all semester. So I'm not going to make you play for a jury. Mm-hmm. If you couldn't play all semester, you still can't play. If you could play, you can still play. I want to know what you charge for a gig. I want to know what your time is worth. Mm-hmm. So when somebody asks you a question, hey, can you play this gig? You know, it's okay to ask, what does it pay? So like, you have to just be mindful of what you say yes to. There was a video that I saw on Instagram, Charlamagne the God. He had this guy on there who said, no is important because yes is expensive. And that instantly changed my life, you know, knowing, hearing it put in such simple terms. And so for these students, you say yes to a $50 gig, that's 3 hours. Once you say yes, it's going to be hard to negotiate up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Instead, say, I can do it for that this time. If you, the player, feels like that gig could be a connection to something else.
Right.
If you don't feel like it's going to connect to something else, if you're just doing it for $50, make sure that your soul isn't going to be hurting when you do the gig. Because if it is, you're better off just like maybe driving Uber for just for a day or something.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. That's such great advice. We've had this exact conversation.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, I'm relatively new to town and I'm not drumming full-time like Nate is, but I'm having to go through that when I meet different artists and songwriters, and you know, they're not all offering $50, but it's like, I have to have that kind of that mindset. And
yeah.
It's like, if I say yes, then what is, it's got to lead to something.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, negotiate your rate too. Don't be afraid to.
Yeah. Just tell them like, this is, or if somebody says, what do you charge? And state your fee.
Yeah.
Say,
and don't be embarrassed about it.
Don't be embarrassed about it. You know,
like, hey, man, yeah, I'm sorry, but this is, you know, there's no reason to be sorry.
I mean, if $200 is your rate, say it. If $500 is your rate, say it. $1,500, you just be able to back it up.
Yeah. Right.
You know, better be able to back it up. And if they say, well, we can't pay that, then you can say, okay, well, what can you do? Now the ball is in their court. Mm-hmm. And if they say $50, at least they know what your target thing is. And so if you say yes to that, mm-hmm. they still know what you value your time as. Say yes, crush it.
Yeah.
And then if they call you again, they know what your price is.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? So that's when you make your value tangible and audible, where they hear like, oh yeah, he does sound like $1,500. He does sound like $500 or whatever your number is. But, you know, if you just settle, then it's hard.
Like over time, you will actually start to attract, like you're going to attract the clients for the price that you set.
Yeah.
Just thinking about the clients that will pay $200 for a gig versus the $50. You probably don't want to be doing the $50, you know, gigs anyway.
You'd be amazed at that when you say no, how something immediately will come right up.
Yeah.
I mean, case in point, it wasn't a no, but like my transition from playing with the CCM artist to playing with Donna Summer, like he called me up and he said, hey, I got to make some changes, blah, 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 you know, and like I had a calendar full of dates with him. And I was like, oh, okay. So that gig ended. 3 days later is when I got the call to play with Donna, which paid substantially more.
Right.
You know, fewer dates, but the fewer dates paid more than all of his would have paid. And when I say fewer, I mean like 15 dates, 5 dates.
Oh, wow.
You know, so not riding in a van, not roommating, having a bus, your own gear, your own 5-star hotel, you know,
room. Entirely different weight class.
Completely different, you know. Yeah. So, but all of that said, when things happen, it's an opportunity for something else to come your way. Not a detriment per se.
Yeah, I think that's great advice for young drummers to hear.
Yeah.
I think you get so pressured, you know, especially when you move into a new city like Nashville.
Sure.
It's like you want to be known, you want to become a name. So you start saying yes to everything and
yeah.
you play for free and yep. do all those gigs. And then, you know, you wonder why, like you're not really advancing your career. It's like
yeah.
maybe you just rethink that mindset of the gigs you are saying yes to.
And there's some wisdom in saying yes to everything when you're brand new. When you're totally an unknown quantity, you're like, yeah, sure, I'll jump into this just because I'm putting myself out. But there's a point when you have to go, okay, now I'm tapering that back off. And then Derek Sivers, maybe you heard this one. I think he made CD Baby.
Okay.
But he said, you want to get to the point where if it's not hell yes, it's no.
Right.
You want everything you're doing to be like, yes.
Yeah.
Hell yes. I'm yeah. doing this. I'm all in.
Yeah.
Great.
Because that yes is expensive.
Right.
You're going to put all of your effort in. If you're going to put half your effort in it, don't bother saying yes, because you're going to do a disservice to yourself and to the other client as well.
Yeah.
You know, because you are going to, your attitude, everything is going to be just kind of very lackluster.
Yeah.
And it's hard, you know, admittedly, there's still certain gigs that I have done that, admittedly. But I am aware of it, you know, and I'm trying to like pull back even more on those yeses so that when I do say yes to something, I feel good about it.
Right.
And I know that I'm going to go in with a good attitude versus begrudgingly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely a good practice to start. The moment you start to feel like, I don't really want to do this anymore,
yeah.
stop.
Yeah.
Please
yeah.
stop, because that will allow the other client to find someone else, or you can help them find someone. You don't have to burn a bridge.
Right,
right.
You know, it's not about that. It's about keeping that bridge together, because you never know what's going to happen later. So keep that yeah. bridge intact, if you can, and move on to something else,
yeah.
you know?
It's not that hard to do.
No, it's not that hard to do. It's just people value sometimes the wrong relationships, and that's just in general beyond music. And you stay in that relationship when you know it's time to move on, and you don't, and you end up feeling weighted.
Right.
And then people can't discern between like, oh, I want to call this person because they're my friend and I want them to play on this, but I know this person plays this better and with the sound that I want.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you have to make that decision on like, do I go with the friend? Do I go with the music? Which one is your North Star?
Yeah.
Your friend or the music? You know, because the friend isn't the product. Music is a product.
Right.
So it's just one of those things where you have, and it's been like, there have been several times where I wanted to play with certain people, but they called the better drummer for the gig. And I'm glad they didn't call me, you know, because
yeah.
I wouldn't want them upset with me if it didn't come out the way they wanted.
Yeah.
Which is also, again, why I'm glad that there are so many musicians moving to town, because now you have, now you can be more specific with your sound instead of being so general with your sound, having yeah. to fit all of these different things. Now you can kind of like tighten your scope a little bit.
That's, I don't think I'd ever thought of it that way, to be grateful that someone else got the gig, because essentially that allows you to keep your reputation pristine.
Yeah.
If
yeah.
you're playing just this, like, I know I can kill it on this. I know. I'm going to come in and I'm just going to ace this thing.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's yeah. cool. Yeah, I agree with that.
I wanted to ask, unless you have something you wanted to jump into.
Go for it, yeah.
So the first time, I've actually met you several times. Now, you probably don't remember. The very first time I met you was at a little show in Cottonwood in California, or rather Anderson. You were playing with Monty Montgomery.
Oh, wow. I don't remember that. But
yeah,
Monty. That's my guy, man. I like that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
He's so much fun.
Yeah, he's fun and he's a monster. There was a guy in the audience playing a harmonica, and he told him to shut the fuck up, which was great because everybody felt the same. Like, why do you think you can do this?
I guarantee you, David Figgert and I were probably just like cracking up, laughing at it.
It's killing me. But yeah, I met you just briefly then. And then I played a show at Rudy's, and I was playing, and I saw you walk in. I was like, "That's Marcus. That guy's awesome." And I felt pretty good about how I played that night. And I actually posted about this just the other day. I think you saw. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, cool. I was swinging pretty good tonight. Yeah, yeah. And then you got up, you set up, and you just sound checked for about 5 seconds. And I went, well, that's too bad.
Yeah, you have that effect.
So that was the night where my band played? Or yeah. Was I playing with somebody?
You were playing. I can't remember who you were
was
playing
it, was with. Was that the clip that you posted?
No, but that, I mean, it was definitely, it was a relevant, relevant clip to what I had experienced. But you just played a little swing for like literally 5 seconds and I went, oh, I have so much work to do.
You thought you had a good set.
Yeah, it was like, I got to rethink the whole night.
I can go down a list of drummers who have made me feel the exact same way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny because, we'll talk about that in a minute, actually, yeah. Because when I met you that first night, I was like, I told you I'd seen you online somewhere and you were like, did you see that video of me playing with Chris Coleman? I was like, yeah. You're like, he murdered me.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, that's what he does to everybody. Yeah. So like, it's not, you know.
He's the punisher, man.
He's just.
But it's like a genuinely sweet cat, man.
He is like the nicest guy. Yeah. Absolutely.
But we'll annihilate your life.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no exceptions to that rule. But I wanted to ask you, what is it that, if you can quantify it in somewhat brief in this podcast time, maybe it's something where you're like, we'd have to talk for 5 hours a day for like a year before I could understand. What is it that makes the difference in that kind of feel? What is it that makes it feel so genuine? I instantly recognized how deep your swing was, like how good your feel was, how ridiculously like precise your touch was. And how do you develop that?
It's, you have to think of music the same way you think of speaking. There are many people who have talked about this, Victor Wooten being one of them. It's so relevant. The way you speak, you have an identity. You have a voice, whether you care for it or not. You have a voice. When you hear it back on a recording, you're like, oh, that's me, you know?
Yeah.
But like now I'm going to sound like I'm like,
that's how stuffy. I feel about this podcast every time.
But you have a voice. You have a particular pattern of speaking. There's certain words that you inflect, certain words you kind of let roll off. If I were to try to imitate your voice on a podcast or over the phone where people couldn't see me, people would go like, sounds like him, but I don't know. Who is this? Mm. You know? So your identity kind of gets lost because you're trying to emulate so many different people that your own voice kind of gets creatively hoarse. Mm. You know, it's like you're stretching it so far and you don't let your own voice muscles develop into its own thing. And you have a regional sound, you know, certain accents from West Coast, East Coast, Midwest, Southern drawl, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Even in the South, there are so many different ones from Alabama to Georgia, Texas, South Carolina, Nashville, Kentucky. I mean, it's like there's very specific sounds that come out of those mouths. And so when you think of music in terms of speaking, nobody can imitate you. You know, it's your voice. And so when you learn a particular vernacular, like if you say, I'm from the South, so that's just how I talk wherever I go.
Right.
You know, and where are you from originally?
California.
California, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So from California, highly unlikely that you're going to develop a Southern accent.
Right.
You know what I mean? You may pick up on some things maybe for survival's sake, but
yeah.
But
there are a few things I've adapted. I don't use, sometimes on purpose I'll still use you guys rather than y'all.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, but that's just because I'm being obstinate.
Right. And intentionally. And there are certain words that I over enunciate here that I didn't grow up talking like.
Yeah.
Because of traveling overseas and traveling to other states, I didn't want anybody to tease me because of my Southern accent. Mm. You know, oh, you're from the South. You're from Memphis. It's like, first of all, we don't talk like that from Memphis. Right. But you just get to a place where your own sound and what you excel at whether it's a topic of discussion, for example, what we're talking about, we're talking about music. If we talk about food, like I love talking about food, mm-hmm. clearly, but you think about the style of swing. It's like that's something that I also love to do. I love just the creative aspect of it. There's so many types of swing. It's just like there's so many types of pizza. You right. know what I mean?
Yeah.
So many different ways of like cooking chicken. So many, you know what I mean? So yeah. you take a food as a genre and how many ways within that genre the swing sound.
Yeah, that's a great
know?
Parallel.
And so you know the ingredient, you know the essence of what it is because you've listened to multiple things. You didn't lock in just on one person.
Right.
You locked in on the style of the language, the vernacular of what it means to play what we call jazz. For me, from Art Blakey, Buddy Rich, Elvin, Tony, Tane Watts, into Martin Guys, Brian Blade, Greg Hutchison, Ulysses Owens, Jameson Ross, Nate Smith. I mean, like, you can go on and on, mm-hmm. you know, Justin Brown.
Cool.
You know,
Justin is one of my favorite players yeah, on the planet.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many different people who you hear their voice. And you can say it's from the ride cymbal. You can say it's from the sound. But, like, even if you switch out,
yeah.
you know, the gear, it still sounds like them. Mm-hmm. Harvey Mason one time, I was playing this festival in Spain. And we had to share a kit for one particular show. And after I played the kit, I got up, he sat down to play it. This is the first time this has ever happened to me because I've shared a kit several times with people and it sounded like the same kit, just sounded like a different player. This sounded like a completely different drum set because I was behind the curtain, I couldn't see, and I thought he swapped some gear around, like snare and like toms, and I peeked back out and it was like, he's playing the same damn things that I was just playing.
Wow.
And it sounds completely different.
Yep.
And that blew my mind. And I didn't understand how he was doing it. Still don't. But I know that now when I play, I'm more focused on trying to find where's the optimal sound on this drum, on this cymbal. How do I? And because a lot of shows that I have done over the last 15 years have been backline shows, fly dates. I just travel with sticks. I don't even travel with cymbals most of the time. So I have a rider and I say specifically what I want. And I show up. And sometimes it's what you want. Sometimes it's not. Right. And you just have to adapt and try to find, like, okay, how do I make this work? And with that, you kind of, like, your ears open up, I feel, even more. At least mine have.
Yeah.
You know, I can't say that I've used the same gear all the time to have a fair and balanced argument on that. I know my gear at home, I guess that is an argument. But, you know, using different gear in different places has helped me to explore and find different things and learning how to tune drums in certain venues that are different drums, different heads, and you're like trying to figure out how do I make this sound good in here.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, your voice, your ability to adapt, you sound different when you play with different people. That's a big thing. It's a huge thing. Certain people that you start narrowing your list of players after your ears start to hear what you sound like. And a person that helped me with that was Kev Moe. He is a big proponent of like listening beyond what we typically say is listening. Like he is listening to each item that's being played in the kit, each person, each part being played. He's listening through the ears of a producer,
yeah,
not just a stage show. So he's looking for everybody to like have a lane and a part, you know, stick to that. And it's a little regiment, but frees you up at the same time because you know your lane.
Yes.
You know, you're never searching.
Yeah.
You know what you have to come back to at all times. So that said, like, you know, I use an app called Live BPM, which kind of measures transients and tells you the tempo that you're playing. I use that live 90% of the time because I am trying to figure out what is my tempo. Like if it says 90 BPM, if I know the song is supposed to be 90, it's not a click track, but I have to feel 90 myself. But then when you play with certain people will maybe play ahead of you. Certain people may play center of you. Certain people play behind you, depending on how they feel it. That's where the drummer's feel starts to almost be compromised and ambiguous at the same time, because if you were to take out everybody out of a track and you're playing, the click is there, but you mute the click and you just hear you playing, you may sound fine. But then when you start adding in the players, depending on where they're playing, may make you sound like you're playing on top or behind, because the ear a lot of times gravitates to the harmonic instruments before it gravitates to the drums. And people sometimes don't even realize that, you know, you're playing on stage, count off a song at the tempo that you know it's supposed to be, and you're playing by yourself, and then everybody comes in and starts to like pull back, and you have to like make a decision. Mm. Do I keep barreling? This is why I don't like playing with a click by myself, because if I'm the only one that hears it and everybody else doesn't hear it,
that's true.
Then it starts to become like the whole, as I say, you end up becoming Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer instead of Santa Claus. I'd rather be anchoring, you know, than pulling.
So in that situation, I'd turn the click off?
Totally.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But at the same time, it's like, you know, when you feel that you can't settle back to where they are either, you just have to kind of like be an amoeba. You know what I mean? You have to be a lava lamp and like just kind of mold around until y'all find it collectively. You know, it's not about chopping them over
right. Like, oh, well, you said it was 90 and I played a 90.
So yeah, it's not about being right.
It's like, no, it's like serve the artist, serve the band.
Right.
And that's our job.
And, you know, and even that serve the artist, serve the band, there's some gray area with that.
Sure,
you know,
there is.
For me, there is, because it's like there are some things we can't quantify. Mm-hmm. Like, what is a tempo? Yeah. Is a tempo 90?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, is the key of the song B flat? All right, let's try to keep it around 90, give or take 1 or 2 BPM. But, you know, if I stop playing for like 8 bars, what's going to happen?
Right.
Is it going to go down to 85? Or are you going to like, you know, where's it going to be? You know, so everybody has a strong part in keeping that time happening. Playing big band, that's another one. You know, with a big band, you have to be lockstep. You have a co-partner, which is a bass player. And if you have a guitar player in a big band, they are also really important, because that ride cymbal can only do so much, and that hi-hat is just a very high-pitched transient. It doesn't drive anything to me.
Yeah.
What drives is the upright. And what drives is if you have Freddie Green type guitar player playing, you know, quarter notes, people hear that. Just like people hear acoustic guitar. When an acoustic guitar starts playing in anywhere downtown, anywhere in Nashville, people's ear,
especially
they go, oh, the guitar player is right, no matter what the drummer is doing.
Right.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Because the guitar player, you know, it's a guitar player. So they have to be right.
Right.
You know, you have to like find that special place. Monty Montgomery, you know, he would sometimes take off, you know, if you weren't careful. And so I had to like find my place playing with somebody like him, who kind of lives on the edge, you know, with his stuff. But then you get somebody like Larry Carlton, who is kicked back in a recliner, the way he's playing, everything is incredibly fierce. But where he places it relative to the drums is just on the backside of it. You know, Kirk Whalum, saxophone player, same, like incredible time. But he will play just on the backside of where you are for feel, say.
Right.
You know, so it's all one of those, it's relative, you know. Kev Moe, he has a place where he would play. Everybody has a specific place they feel it. And the way to kind of determine it, I think, is just to have a drum machine play and let them play to that and see where they, if you want to get to the nuts and bolts of like, where's your feel? Because you're not going to argue with this drum machine.
Right.
You know, so.
Is that tempo wrong? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I've always said that too. Okay.
Go in the back corner there and you guys duke it out.
Yeah. Nobody argues with the stems.
Whenever,
but if the drummer is the only one hearing the stems, they'll argue with the drummer.
Yeah. Whenever I've played with some artists, especially downtown, where like, it's faster than this. I go, here's the tempo. We can play it faster if that's what you want, but it isn't faster than this.
Right.
It is this tempo. Like,
it's not that key. Oh, yes, it is key. Yeah. I can't sing it that fast. Well, say that.
Yeah, that's fine.
You know, that's fine. I get that. So, I mean, that happened recently. We were playing a song and I started it at the tempo. It was a cover tune.
Yeah.
And singer turned around, like, whoa, guys, this is like blazing fast. It's like too fast. I said, okay, well, play it. You have the guitar. Play it where you want. And he played it like 7 clicks slower. And I said, okay. And I had the live BPM on. I was like, all right, we'll put it there. Yeah. No problem. And then he asked, like, was that the record tempo? I was like, record tempo is where we had it. But this is like, if this is where you want it.
I've been in that situation.
That's fine. Yeah.
It's totally fine. But don't jump out of your pants saying like, hey, this is too fast.
Yeah,
right.
Like,
don't be mad at me for knowing the song.
I need to attenuate your tone.
Yeah.
Need you to low pass that.
Yeah. I'm keeping that one.
That should be a t-shirt. Yeah.
Attenuate your tone.
So. Man, it's cool hearing like your story of watching him play. I feel like I had the same thing happen to me. I think I've only seen you once, which is crazy. I need to come out and see you more. But it was at Wind Down Nashville.
Okay.
You know, last year.
Oh, yeah. Jerome.
Was that with the Marcus Finney Band?
Well, it was like a trio. It was an adaptation.
Yeah,
that group, we played together at Rudy's, but we just played some of my music that particular night. But yeah, guitar and organ and drums.
Yeah.
That was the first time doing that, my stuff with that setup.
That was fun.
It was fun, yeah. Played, I think I had a kick snare hat, or did I have a cajon too?
Yeah, it was something unique. I remember talking to you about it after.
I think I sat on a cajon, but had a kick, snare, hat, and a ride. Mm-hmm. And so it was playing a combination of, it was like made up that night, that day. But we had fun.
Yeah. I see you as like a Dennis Chambers or a, you know, Chris Coleman, someone like a drummer that we can just watch for like an hour. Just the drummer playing. I mean, just be so entertained the whole time. That's kind of how felt with your playing. It's just so interesting.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Very unique. And maybe kind of go into that. We kind of touched upon some of your favorite influences and drummers, but I guess like, who are you listening to now? Who are your current influences?
I mentioned Nate Smith. His latest record is incredible. And I dig a lot of the stuff that Snarky has done. You know, the sound that they brought.
Larnell and
Big
Sput.
And
Jameson.
Jameson and JT.
Yeah.
Jason Thomas. Yeah. It's like, you got four incredible drummers, sometimes all playing at the same time, which is pretty amazing. Yeah. Like three of them at least playing at the same time, but never stepping on each other. Everything is so detailed with that group. You have to be when you got like 97 people playing. Yeah. You know, it's Michael League is, I mean, I admire what he's done. Yeah. Heavily, you know. And some other people, I just find playlists on Apple Music or Spotify, and I just listen to what the latest playlist is of certain things. And some of the stuff that comes up, man, I'm like, I mean, obviously JD Beck and Domi, they have their album out. Anderson Pop, you know. I mean, just as a drummer, Anderson is cold-blooded.
Oh,
like,
yeah, he is.
Like, for, like,
yeah, he's
real. You know what I mean?
His feel.
Yeah, his feel, but also his chops are like freaking amazing. So, I mean, yeah, it's kind of all over the place with that. One thing that I do is I find playlists. This is the one thing I like about Spotify. One is that people will curate playlists. So you type in Jeff Porcaro session tracks, or you type in Roger Hawkins or Bernard Purdy, any session studio drummer, you type in their name, Spotify, and you type in their name and playlist, a long list of songs pop up. And it's a good way to study the identity of a player across albums, across decades, across genres, mixes, sonic, everything. It's just like you hear them. You know what I mean?
I need to see if they've got one for Gary Novak. I've been on a Gary kick.
I'm pretty sure they do. And he is, again, another one of those amazing cats, man. And an amazing person, man. I got to hang with him a couple times. And just a funny dude, man. Seriously bad cat.
He's scary.
And what's my other guy's name? He played with Larry for a minute. Looks very animated. Tosh Panos.
Okay.
Another one, man. Mm-hmm. That's like incredible, you know? Yeah. But yeah, that's kind of what I've been doing. I've gone down the path of like listening to specific drummers, or if I on those jazz playlists or top pop playlists, Billie Eilish, I like her stuff, you know. The Weeknd, Dua Lipa.
Yeah.
You know. I just dig some of this stuff that's out. I got a country playlist to try to like hear sonically what's going on drum sound wise, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a lot of the same stuff. A lot of it is samples, of course, just with everything, a lot of stuff is sampled. It's not just country, but just to hear kind of what it is and see if anything has changed pattern wise. A lot of it is the same, but that's just the nature of, you know, it's not to be frowned upon. I used to frown on it. People certainly tell you that, but I used to frown on like, you're doing the same old thing over and over and over again. Well, one of my favorite drummers is definitely a proponent of playing the same solos over and over again, and it always works.
Yeah.
Steve Gadd.
Oh, yeah.
It's the same thing, and I never get tired of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He could start that. I'm like, I'm falling over. You know what I mean?
Yep.
His feel, I mean, because everything he plays is committed. And so I think a lot of times we kind of overlook that, circling back to everything we've talked about, the commitment of what you play is going to reign supreme over any lick that you play.
Yeah,
that's great.
You know what I mean? So if you're committed to that one hit, like I Will Always Love You, Ricky Lawson, when he hits that boom, and when he hits that, the commitment behind it, that's like one hit.
Yeah.
And it's like
iconic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Takes your breath away. And
having that conviction.
Having a conviction, sure. You know, James Gadson, you know, his 16th note grooves, you know what I mean? Jeff Beccaro. I mean, it's like you can go down a list of names and it's the Steve Jordan. Any drummer named Steve, just about. Steve Ferroni, you know. It's like the commitment that they have is what makes it, there's no question mark over their head. It's just an exclamation point at all times. No matter the volume, Art Blakey, definitely.
Yep.
Definitely 100% committed in everything that he played. Dynamics. I mean, I will say, like, I got into Art later, and by later, I mean like 20 years ago. Art, what I love about his playing is he was a piano player first. So, you know, he has incredible chops, but it never got in the way of the song. He's a very, to me, a very unique drummer from that era. Where, you know, they'll be burning something and his ride cymbal will be like super low playing. And then all of a sudden he will like come out of nowhere and like throw the kitchen sink at you and then come right back down.
Yeah.
So stealth, you know, with everything that he does, those press rolls. And then when he goes into his, he's another one. He'll play almost the same type of drum solo. I mean, like, play a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah.
Never get tired of it because he's completely 100% committed.
Yeah. And also what you were saying, like, to, you know, find your lane and find your niche, like, those drummers that you mentioned, like, they become known for those things. And that's, like, why, you know, why change or why, why fix what's not broken kind of thing.
Right. Vinny is one of the anomalies, man. Like, because he's, like, he's known for constantly evolving, you know. He has a sound because of that, but you're not going to pinpoint a lick.
Right. Yeah.
You're just not, you know. Herbie Hancock, he has certain voicings that you're like, oh, that sounds like a Herbie chord. But you're going to be hard-pressed to find him repeating himself.
That's true.
Certain people have just the ceiling that they don't know where the ceiling is.
Yeah.
You know, I can see mine. You know, I walk slightly, you know, hunched over because of the ceiling. But,
yeah.
You know, it's one of those things, man, where you have the commitment. You find your favorite words that you like to use in a conversation. You bring it up when you're talking to somebody. You know, you're not, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who may have, like, this incredible vocabulary. Like, if you ask Neil deGrasse Tyson, like, hey, man, how's that light bulb work? He can look at you and assess, like, I can either give him all the big words or I can help him understand.
Right.
You know, and which one is more important, me flexing my words or this person who asked a question understanding?
Yeah, those are the best teachers.
Yeah.
To figure that out.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think of music the same way in certain ways. It's like you can give them, like, all of your chops or you can wow them with a word or two, but then still make sure they're with you.
Yes.
You know, and a person who, again, I'm going to say his name for probably the fourth, fifth time, Nate Smith, is like incredible with that.
Yes,
like,
he is.
I've been to one of his shows and was blown completely away by his ability to put the audience in the palm of his hand. And they'll be playing an odd meter thing, but he's grooving it super hard. And then his ability to stop for two counts and then drop back in resets that audience's, like, their endorphins, their, like, everything, like, their adrenaline just, like, pops out in that those two bars of space, and it kind of resets it. So he's one of those. Victor Wooten is really incredible with, like, just the, you know, like, the weight that he makes you wait for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's an art to that. But it also goes along with how you speak, you know, how you communicate, because this music is communication.
Yeah, that's great.
What's that you said? You want to learn how to play drums, but you don't know where to begin? Let me humbly suggest to you that you head on down to Music Lab Nashville and you talk to their crew of fantastic teachers and you jump on in and start your music journey right there. Don't want to learn drums? Want to learn guitar? Ukulele? Mandolin? Trumpet? Vocals? Keys? Sitar? Maybe not sitar, but all that other stuff for sure. Visit nashville.musiclab.co to learn more and sign up for a free trial lesson.
So you mentioned the word identity a few times. Definitely want to talk about your new record that came out, what, a few weeks ago now?
Came out actually Friday.
Okay.
It was released on Bandcamp, and it's just a single.
So July 15th, right?
Yeah.
By the time this airs, so we'll reference back to it.
Well, it was released on Bandcamp 15th, but the 29th is when it actually released on, like, streaming.
Oh, perfect.
So, cool. But yeah, I was trying to, like, direct everybody to Bandcamp. that song, ironically, I recorded in 2015.
Okay.
Got the guys together. We went to Sony Tree and recorded there. Doug Mosier on saxophone, Brian Allen on bass, and Jason Webb on piano. Jason is known a lot around town as being a session piano player. He's not known as a jazz player, and I kind of hate to even qualify people in that way, like, he's a jazz guy, because I don't like being qualified that way personally. But, you know, he's such a great player, and clearly on this project, man, he played his butt off. That was the first song that I've ever written, actually. I wrote it in 2004 or 2005, and I was using Reason to write it. And I started with a legal pad of just rhythms, and I wrote the title Identity. I wrote 3/4, and I just wrote measures A, B, C, D, and just wrote rhythms for every line. No pitch, no key, no nothing. And went in to Reason and started programming just a baseline figure. And I would have to, like, do a step entry because I don't play piano. So I would write out the baseline for 1 bar, 2 bar, and just go on and copy paste if I needed to, and had phrases written. So I have baseline kind of like spelling out one type of thing. Got this drum groove playing. Then I program the rhythms for the melody, but it's just like non-pitched. It's just in there. Then I start moving them to pitches based on the bass line. The bass line is spelling out something, so the melody kind of counteracts. And that's kind of how, when you hear the song, it sounds like the bass is its own melody, and the melody from the sax is another thing. So they're happening at the same time. And then because you have the bass and the melody, you can kind of figure out what the chord is supposed to be. And over time, it evolved, playing it live with different people, getting new ideas, and then finally, 10 years later, recorded it. And at first, I was going to wait until I had a full album of that particular sound, but it was taking too long, clearly. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to put this out. But there are other songs that I have ready to record. I have about 5 that I'm ready to record. It's just a matter of getting in there and doing it. So, but Identity, yeah, I'm excited about it. It was playlisted. I know that's kind of a big thing now. It's on a Spotify playlist, all new jazz or something like that. And
was it a playlist you made?
No.
Just to get back to
right. The drummer's playlist.
Yeah, right.
But and then there's a young lady in Europe. Her name is Ruth. I forget her last name, but I'll send you the link to the radio station that she has over in Europe. And she reached out to me about playing it on her station, which I got excited about as well. So, because I've never really pushed too hard. Like, I'll give it a month or two, and then I kind of back off. I'm like, nobody wants to hear it. You know what I mean? And I'm not very diligent about the promotional thing.
It's that tough balance of being the artist and then being like the marketer behind it and trying to, you know, self-promote.
Yeah.
It's always a challenge.
It's very tough.
You have to have enough ego to believe in your product. But then to do that, the counterbalance of that is you believe it will push itself. It's good, so it should push itself, right?
Right.
Okay, those two things have a hard time coexisting.
That's why you have a creative department and an administrative department.
Yep.
at a label. You just need a team, like a marketing team, you know, and who's going to say, all right, we got that part done. Now you need to do this. And it's like, wait, you want me to make a TikTok video? You know what I mean? It's like, but I mean, that type of stuff, it's all about who you're trying to reach and...
Know your audience
and communicate with your audience. And it's hard. Like I said, I've been a side guy so long. Like the thought of like stepping out into the artistry thing, like beyond the radius of Nashville. I mean, it's just kind of like, I know how I want to travel.
Yeah.
I know I'm used to traveling a particular type of way. And if I have to step down from that, that's going to be really hard.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, and I definitely want the players playing with me to be comfortable. Because I know what it's like to be a side guy.
Yes.
And I don't want them to feel like they're a side guy with accommodations and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, and I know there's just some realities that you just have to get over, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that too. Just like, do you feel like you have a unique perspective of now kind of running, you know, running your own group and then kind of being more of the artist and the composer from being like the sideman and obviously growing up as a drummer? You know, what do you feel you've kind of taken away from those two different roles?
So I know when I was younger, I definitely wanted to write, but didn't think at that time I could because I wasn't a piano player. It wasn't until I learned MIDI that I was like, maybe I can. And so we all have something we can say. It may not be at MIDI songs, but I'm a proponent, man, of like, do your own stuff. Mm. You know, that is one thing that I definitely try to instill in students too. Do your own thing. It's nice to cover stuff,
yeah.
You know, to do stuff that people know. I want to play something they know. It's like, well, they'll never know your stuff if you don't play it.
Yeah.
So play your stuff. And that song is not making you really any money. You're making that writer money.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. You know, in fact, study the writing. Study it. And it's not to say that everybody's going to be a writer. That's, you know, I'm definitely not trying to say that because there are certain people who are just gifted players or gifted performers, singers, and then there are certain people who are just gifted writers and not singers.
Yeah.
There are certain people who should have just written and never stepped out to sing. I can name some, but I won't. Yeah. But there are people who, in my opinion anyway, sometimes we get caught up in how good a song is because of the lyrics, forgetting that that person really can't sing. You know, and then there are certain people who are really incredible singers, but you don't realize how bad the song is because you're so enamored by how well they sing.
Yeah.
So, you know, and so it's like both polar opposites, both ends. That's why I say administrative, creative, mm-hmm. have a writer, a team of writers and performers and like, and co-write, you know, do your thing, be a part of it. Don't shy away from that. But understanding what good writing is comes from studying the greats, studying your Carole Kings, James Taylors, Lionel Richies, Babyface. Like you can go on and on and on and on. The Bergmans, lyricists, people who are poetic. When you hear the song, you hear poetry. Mm-hmm. Even if you just read it without singing the melody, you just read it and it's like, this is a good story.
Yeah.
You know, not every song calls for that. Some songs are just party songs and that's fine. Yeah. Some songs have no lyrics. Some songs are just melody. Like, can you construct a melody that's singable? It's not too out. If it is out, then that's how you feel and that's great, you know? But again, I just say like, think about honesty and think about like, okay, is your honesty going to reach? How many people do you think that honesty is going to reach? Bottom line, as long as you're honest, it's just two different paths of thinking on being creative in this industry. One is like serving money. The other is serving yourself as honesty.
Yeah.
And the money comes from like, you know, I want to reach to all the people. It's like, okay, well, are you going to be genuine with them, or are you going to be honest? Are you going to be honest with them, or are you going to just say what, you know?
What sells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. So don't Benny Hinn.
Oh.
You know? You know, like still be honest, because you're going to have to live with that.
Yeah.
You know, later on, you're going to have to live with that. So that's just kind of where my head is on.
Yeah. I like you said too about, just quick about, you know, having a team, starting yourself, having that awareness to, like, you know, especially as drummers, like, we don't necessarily have that marketing mindset, or like think of ourselves as our brand, you know, to like, you know, hire a photographer and get, sure, you know, headshots done, yep, or cool photos or something like that, or have a website. But that's important.
I mean, and it costs too, man. It's like, you have people that will give you a deal, but depending on the quality of marketing that you want, it costs money.
Not, yeah, sure.
So, like the making the music is, in theory, the easiest part. Hmm. It's the marketing. Mm-hmm. That's where your budget.
All those pieces.
Yeah, it's like 70% of your budget right there is marketing. 30% is doing a record. It's like, yeah, doesn't take much to go in and play.
Yeah, it's right. My music. I've for, you know, in your case, like, you wrote it, you know, 10 years ago. You go in, yeah, get the guys together, you rehearse, you do it, you know, a few takes, whatever it was. And now, how do we tell the world about it,
right,
in a way that does it justice?
How do you create the wow thing? Yeah. You know, some people just kind of like, oh, I just want to hide behind. I don't want my face on a thing. And, you know, I don't want to say anything about it. Well, why'd you record it? Mm. Again, like, that's part of the unfortunate piece about the music industry that exists, is this thing of like, if I create it, people will just like it. It's like, name me a single restaurant where that's worked. I mean, like, you have, like, you still have to market. Word of mouth works.
Yeah.
Right.
To a degree, you know, like, if you were to open a restaurant and didn't tell anybody, you just expect people to just walk in. Nobody knows you, who you are, because you're in the back kitchen. You got somebody else serving the floor. You're not being personable. It's like, but you have incredible food, but nobody knows your story. Nobody knows, you know. And so at that point, you know, it's like the truth of what your intent was kind of comes out. You never wanted to really make money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Essentially. You just wanted to create something.
Or even serve
just
others.
For the sake of, yeah, creating something. Mm. And you did it, and you spent the money on doing it. You don't want to make it back.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, going back to, like, your guy from CD Baby, like, be all in. Yes. Yeah. Like, I'm excited about this. I want to promote this. I want to do this. You know, do it. You know? Maybe easier said than done, because I know I get the financial piece of it. But, like, as far as you being out there, like, you had Prince's shirt on, man. It's like, I mean, he was the king of, like, being mysterious and, like, keeping, when he made an appearance, he made an appearance.
Yeah, he did.
He could be 4 hours late.
Yeah.
He made an appearance, and he was dressed to the nines. You, yeah, know what I mean? And
doing all these secret gigs.
Yeah.
Showing up last minute when nobody knew, and then just like, Prince is here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's doing a gig with the full, they're like, oh my God.
Yeah, man. And so it's, yeah, like, so it's like people like him and several other people who can like maintain that mystique. And when they show up, it's like, oh man, such and such is here, you know? But like, you have to, it doesn't just happen like that. There's still strategy involved, and people, I don't know what people are thinking sometimes, but
I think like everything, it's a balance, you know, because, yeah, if at the other end of the spectrum, like if you're just screaming every day to people,
oh God,
whether,
yeah,
it's, you know, Instagram posts or emails,
music,
then it's like, all right, turn that off.
Right? Yeah.
But mute. It's like, if you're someone that's like, to that was a great example of Prince, like, you know, if you post maybe once a month, but every time you do, it's like, quality content, or it's a, mm-hmm, new release. It's like, okay,
yeah,
it's quality over quantity.
Precisely. Yeah. Precisely.
I want to talk more about recording, just kind, sure, of on that subject. You're definitely known as a session player in town. Mm-hmm. Specifically too, like, talk about 2020 for you, and because I know I've seen a lot of your content and kind of building the home studio and, mm-hmm, kind of having to adapt, like we talked about. And
sure.
Because I know you record a lot at really great studios here in town and elsewhere, but how important was that to have your place at your house?
Oh, man, that was big time for me. Like, it was something that I'd been wanting to do anyway, and the pandemic just kind of made it a priority.
For so many people.
Yeah. It just made it a priority.
Thinking about it, it was like, all right, now it's being decided for me. I kind of have to do this.
Yeah. Thing. I mean, I wanted to build it in the attic, but, you know, that was going to be like a $25,000 thing. And I was like, well, let me just get all the pieces that I need first, the gear, and just set up in the garage. We have a 2-car garage. I parked on the street and eventually made like a cube, like a shanty with a little roof. My ceilings are 14 feet high. So once I got room mics, it changed everything. It's like made my room sound massive. But then if I turn room mics off, it sounds nice and tight and not like a garage. And, you know, started accumulating mics, external pre's. Very last big purchase that I did was the UAD. And I got that last because a friend of mine, the infamous text thread that I'm on, he said, you need to get external pre's first because they don't need software updating. And they maintain their value because of that. And get the UAD last. So I did. And he's right. I mean, it's like the UAD stuff sounds incredible, but it's even better when it hits an external pre going into the UAD.
Yeah.
Are
you still using those warm audio mics?
Not the mics. I'm borrowing currently a Warm 84 as a condenser mic on a top snare next to an i5. The overheads right now, because I was tracking two different songs today, I have the Octava 012s overhead right now. And for one song, I used the McLeod Fet 47 as a crotch mic. For the second song, I used the Steiger 2N ribbon mic as a crotch mic. Warm Audio 84 and i5 Audix top snare, then bottom snare was a 57. Hi-hat is a M130 Baradynamic. Toms D4, and then the floor tom is a 421. The kick in is a D6. The kick out is a AEA 84, and then the sub kick is a Solomon, and the room mics are Fatheads. Cascades.
Man, all the audio nerds listening right now are probably like, "Sounds pretty good." Yeah,
and so it's the biggest thing, obviously, with any drummer when you have that many mics, it's phase. You know, trying to make sure polarity, whatever the word is, and I get corrected on it all the time. But just making sure everything is aligned and you don't have like canceling, audio.
But you had most of acquired a lot of that skill from MTSU, right? When you switched to
totally.
Recording,
absolutely, yeah. That was the main reason why I relatively knew kind of what to do.
See, Lala was right.
I know.
He's always right.
He always wants to hear that too. But yeah, it helped a lot, man, knowing signal flow and doing sessions and working with different engineers. I have definitely some favorite engineers that I've worked with around town where I hear the drum sounds that they get and I'm like, how did you do that?
Yeah.
You know.
Now, I'm curious, are you mostly asked, I'm sure it's a variety of this, but are you mostly asked to just track drums and then those raw stems get then, you know, sent to the producer or another engineer? Or are you actually delivering processed recordings from your studio?
Most of the time it's raw. I still run it through like one of my templates is SSL 4K and UAD. I have that one. I did another one of the API and another one of the Neve 88RS. The SSL has been my favorite though. And I will EQ ever so slightly, just like the high pass, maybe the hat a little bit, even through the MOG pre-Qs, because ribbons are so warm. Hmm. And then if there's something that is like, that doesn't sound good, like if it's like a build and like 250, 300 hertz, maybe dial that back just a little bit. But mostly it's pretty raw. It's just hearing the mic go through the software processor of SSL, how warm it sounds and how full, how much it fills out on some of the low end. It's just, that's great. So yeah, mostly the preamps and then the UAD and I don't EQ my, I definitely don't compress. And the room mics, I try to leave them flat if I can. Yeah. Sometimes I'll add certain things if I feel like it's too dull or if I don't trust the engineer that's going to be mixing. That's when I'll go in and like do some stuff. But if I know the engineer and I will reach out to them and say, hey, what do you want me to do? I even, one time, I think it was this year actually, first week of the year when it snowed, I was supposed to do a session at Dark Horse and I ended up testing positive for COVID. And the day before, and I reached out to her and I said, hey, because it hadn't snowed yet. So I reached out to her. I said, hey, I tested positive, blah, blah, blah. I said, but I am set up at home and I can record remotely. Since you have all these songs, she had like 7 or 8 songs. She had them all tracked with piano and vocal to a click. And so I said, why don't y'all still go in? I'll do the Zoom link and Audio Movers link for the engineer there, and they have an SSL console there. And so I said, hey, we got on Zoom, and I gave him permission, remote access to my SSL software.
So, wild,
so
right?
He could, and we did a sound check, like hitting the snare, he's dialing it in on my software.
Yeah.
And toms, overheads, all of that. The only thing he couldn't do was like move any mics. Yeah. But yeah, he got it dialed in the way he wanted it. And so while they were getting sounds, I was already tracking one of the songs. And when they were ready, I was done with that. I was on the second song. I made a drum bounce of it. And I sent him all the stems, Dropbox. He just pulled in the MP3 drum bounce, let them play along with that. Had all the other stems, and I was on to the next song. So I stayed like 2 songs ahead.
That's amazing.
Meanwhile, it was like snowing apocalypse outside.
Yeah,
you know?
Wow.
But I was able to salvage that session.
Yeah.
By recording remotely. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
But again, just being able to adapt and, you know, obviously been a huge part of your success.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how have you kind of balanced that with, I mean, you still do in studio sessions. Does it just depend on the artist and
sure.
what they prefer?
Yeah. I still love doing in studio.
Yeah.
For sure.
Any favorite studios in town?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I'm forgetting the name. It was during the pandemic, so I recall scenes. It was a really high-quality video that was getting filmed. I think it's in somewhat new studio.
Studio Nash? Or Lehman?
No. Scott, I think it's like a very white room, and it's like very tall ceilings. They have like this cool stairwell, I think, too.
Oh, yes.
You know what I'm talking about?
It's over there near Green Hills off Granny White.
Yeah, I think so.
Gray Box.
Gray Box, yeah.
Yeah.
You're doing some sessions there, right?
I was.
Were you doing those Yurt Rock play-alongs?
I did.
That was?
Yeah. Cool. We did some Yurt Rock with Jay White and Adam Smith.
Yeah.
That was fun. Adam Smith and I talked about that the other day. We were on a video shoot together and we were like, man, we got to do that again. That was a ton of fun. Yeah. It's like some of my favorite studios. Ocean Way, obviously, is one of them. Soul Train. I just tracked there for the first time a couple months ago. The Studio Nash. I've been tracking there a bit. And it's always going to be studios where I feel like the drum sound is like great. Like Sony Tree, I love that sound. Yeah, there are definitely quite a few. I love the vibe whenever I track it. A friend of mine, Casey Wozner, the Purple House out in Leaper's Fork, great sounding room. Butch Walker's room, man. Ooh. His studio is, he has 2 different rooms. He has like a ISO room and then he has this big live room. And I played in the ISO room and he is such an incredible engineer. And he's one of those that will record with effects to tape on the drums.
Wow.
You know, so I'm like listening to like a delay, you know, that was a really cool thing. And it created the vibe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And he's like, he said, no, man, I commit. I want to, you know, if we're going to do it, let's do it. I'm like, yeah. So, so yeah, his room is great. It's a couple, definitely other rooms around. It always usually depends for me. Like 70% of it, I will say not that much. I'll say 50% of it is a room, 50% is engineer. As far as, you know, if your drums and you are like the ground zero, like you have your thing. Now, will the room mess it up? Or will the engineer mess it
everything
up?
Everything has to be quite nice.
Yeah.
If you hadn't said that, I was going to say, well, there's certainly a large part that's your actual product.
Yeah. You have your definite part. But like, if, you know, if the drums are out of phase, or
right.
you know, if the snare drum is like non-existent, you know, it's like, yeah, man, turn the snare up.
Yeah.
So it can make you sound weak.
Yeah, it's true.
You know,
I had to very nicely tell an engineer that what he was doing made no sense. It's like, I'm seeing you're playing this smaller snare and it's pretty high tuned. So I pulled some of the lows out of it. So I'm like,
you did what?
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Ever. Yeah, that's a really dumb thing you just did.
Yeah, you get experimental engineers who will do some of the oddest things. And at that point, you have to go, okay, well, let me get my best performance and like get my check and leave.
Yep.
There's, I mean, even after you leave, they're still going to, they may still mess it up or they may sound replace. I mean, I've definitely had some people like sound replace stuff super out of context. You know, it's like, tell me or let me hear the sample that you're going for so I can tune my drums as close to that as I can so I can play with that sensitivity.
Yeah.
Because if you have, if I'm playing with like a piccolo snare and you want the snare to be a 6.5, you know, gushy snare, all those ghost notes that I'm doing are now compromised.
Right.
You know, because it's not going to sound good on this gushy sound.
No.
You know, so let's find what that is first.
I like that approach. Before you replace it,
give me a chance. Give me a chance. And obviously, it depends on, you know, what you're playing. But I've heard certain recordings of songs where I'm like, I know that drummer was probably playing this particular sound and it got sound replaced by an engineer who is one-dimensional, who didn't listen to the style of what was being recorded. They just knew their bucket of EQ tricks and their bucket of samples, and they were like, well, this is what my ear is used to, despite, again, the song and the style. It's just like, I'm used to this. It's like, sometimes that gets a little selfish.
Yeah.
You know, but again, I have to circle back to my guy, Steve Gadd. His drums always sound the same.
They do.
No matter what genre he's playing. Same snare, thuddy. Yeah. You know, sometimes.
Doesn't even tune it equal on all sides.
Same cymbals. Like, he kind of defies, he kind of like usurps the whole, like, oh, I need to have, like, you know, I need to bring 6 kick drums to a session. I need to bring 9 snares, you know. He brings 4 of the same snares, if I'm not mistaken. So it's like you are getting him. He is like the classic version of like you're getting the artist, their voice. You're not going to ask, you know, Casey Musgraves to sing like Carrie Underwood.
Right.
You know what I mean? You're getting Casey. You're getting Carrie. You're getting whoever, Taylor. You're getting them. So, but as musicians, we get caught up in gear.
So much more we can just do with that one snare drum to tune it differently.
Totally.
You know,
I did a YouTube video about that with like, picked some of my favorite Pearl snares and I tuned them 3 different ways, high, medium, low. And they all have a particular characteristic. You want to have your snares, you want to find the optimal sound for that snare.
Right.
If you can, if you have the quantity of snares to be able to like say that snare is this, that snare is that, you know what I mean? But in general, some of my friends who do sessions 9 to 5 around town, they'll tell you, man, it's like 4 snares, each of them tune high, medium, low, super low or whatever. And they'll maybe tweak it to where if they have to tune it to a particular note of the key of the song, they'll do that. You know, I just started getting asked to do that this year. Like, can you tune it to the, I was like, huh, okay. Like something I was doing for a girl named Annie Bosco. I said, girl, young lady, Annie Bosco. Tommy Sims was producing. He wanted the snare tuned to a particular note. Danny Duncan was engineering, one of my favorite engineers. And I was like, okay. I'm like tuning and I'm hitting it and I hear, I'm like, okay, it sounds like an A flat. And I asked, I said, am I close in there? And he's like, he said, hit it. Yeah, that's it. I was like, all right, cool.
Yeah.
Another session.
I've heard that more with tom relations, but not as much as with a specific snare to be that pitch.
Because that's going
to
be hit the most.
Yeah.
Right. You know, then I did a session with Josh Stone, Christmas album, and her producer, Steve, said, hey, Let's get the drums tuned to the key. Like, all right,
cool.
Wow. You know, I'm kind of game with that. I mean, at first I didn't think I would really like that. And I'm only using, sometimes on those sessions, I'm only using a rack and the floor. I'm not using four toms. That would be a problem.
Yeah.
I do tune my toms in fourths in general. It's not even intentional. It's just that's just where I hear them. No matter what the starting pitch is, I just tune them in fourths away from each other. I don't like to hear that rub. But as far as tuning to a key, I tend not to do, especially for a live show. That's pointless.
Yeah.
You know? In fact, a lot of times I'll mute the toms with Roots EQs or something.
Okay. Yep.
Yeah, I'll put those on, get that tubby short sound. You can get away with a lot more, I think, when it's a short tom.
Yeah, true. For sure.
Get away with a whole lot
yeah,
more.
Yeah, throw a towel on there.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
What do you love most about recording? How did you kind of get into being a session drummer in the first place?
The final product, man. Like, knowing that you've been a part of something that's documented, that is cool, and that you can hear growth in your own playing. I like the sounds. I like the process, especially when you can take your time and really, not, it's not a rush job. Kev, again, going back to Kev Moe, he's very big into that. Like, let's get the sounds coming in correct, not replacing stuff. Like, he's like EQing, he EQs heavily going to tape. And he wants the source of each instrument. If it's a bass, he wants you to dial it in first so he can leave it flat. So he wants you to like take off some of that low end.
Yeah.
And like stop trying to like eat all of that real estate up down there and expecting the engineer to do it. You dial it in.
Right.
Yourself. Like, I don't need to count on them to gate the toms. I need to do that.
Yeah.
On my own. Because if I do it, then I'll play a particular way, and then they don't have to like kill the ghost notes, you know?
Yeah, I love that mindset of kind of like, as you said, mixing yourself behind the kit as totally. If you are in the studio.
You'll see Questlove or Bernard Purdy, you know, people put a cloth, like a really light cloth on cymbals to kind of tame it a little bit. Moon gel. I use drum dots and moon gel on cymbals at times. And sometimes, you know, gaff tape in the bottom head of the tom so that the top can still be open, but that bottom head shortens the sustain a bit. Putting a case under the floor tom, like a Pearl double pedal case, shorten the distance between the floor tom and the floor from like, you know, 14 inches down to like 6 inches without putting anything on the heads. When you hit the floor tom now, the sustain is substantially shorter.
Yes.
So little tricks like that, learning, watching YouTube, watching people like Aaron Sterling, man, who's like amazing.
Yeah, we talk about him almost every podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk to him on this podcast too.
So, I mean, and what's the other guy on YouTube? That sound.
There's so many. Sounds like a drum.
Sounds like a drum.
Yeah.
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 The stuff that he's put out is
they're
amazing.
They're awesome, yeah.
Yeah.
Cody and Ben.
Yeah. Really, really incredible stuff. So I just like the learning process of it all, like discovering new stuff and hearing different approaches. I asked Harvey Mason, how does he play to a click? He said he plays just slightly behind it so he can hear it. Some people like bury the click. That's another way of doing it, you know. It's just getting all of these ingredients so that when it's time for you to cook that particular meal, you know what the recipe is.
Yeah, bringing it back to food. I love it.
Always. Always.
Yeah, that's so cool. Do you find that it's recording has sort of maybe come easier? Not that it was ever hard for you, but like in terms of, I know some people have like, you know, the red light fever and they get nervous or they have multiple takes. Like,
totally. Yeah. It started
to get that experience early on.
Absolutely. And there are still times where it's still kind of like, it depends on who you're playing with. You know, it depends. It just depends on, it's so many things. Like, is this a familiar session? Is it familiar company? Is a song your wheelhouse? Really, it comes down to that, you know. Is a song in your wheelhouse? If it's not, then that's when you really get nervous.
Yeah.
You know, I did a session where I was subbing for drummer Scott Williamson. It was a orchestral date at Ocean Way. And I was in my own booth. You had like 70-piece orchestra on the floor and bass next to me across the control room, piano. And I was asked to do it because, you know, he was like, man, K can you do this? Can you sub for me on a session? So I go in and I get the book. I'm looking at it. The conductor comes in before the session, talks to me for a little bit. And it wasn't until we took the first break that I came out of the booth and like, then everybody on the floor saw me, like friends of mine who were up there. I'm like, man, I didn't know you were in there. But it was cool because I was brought in to read and nothing else. Yeah. And the camaraderie, the vibe was, it was really cool. But there was some nervousness there because a lot of the stuff was written out drum part wise. Yeah. And sometimes when you're having a sight read drum parts versus just sight reading key figures, it's very different. Reading the tom fill, you know, yeah. And a hi-hat pattern that you have to play with the snare drum kind of on, off, you know, all of this type of stuff. Your adrenaline pumps because you're excited. You're nervous, but it's not like nervous, like, I don't know what I'm doing. So it's just a little different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
So we talked a bit about the cooking thing.
Sure.
And it's very obvious that you're studious kind of in everything that you do. You attending and being, what did you say your role is? Assistant?
Kitchen assistant.
Kitchen assistant. All right. Obviously, you've taken that role to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that obviously applies to your musical career as well. So this was just a total random thought I had, but did you ever watch Chef's Table?
No, I keep hearing about it, and I do need to watch. Somebody just mentioned it to me 2 days ago, and I need to watch it.
I would love to get your opinion of it, because even as a person, I mean, I cook, but I don't take it nearly as seriously as
True.
You obviously do. But as a musician, watching it and watching the way these chefs think about food, it was like watching someone write a symphony. I'm finishing these episodes, and they're
It's totally
bringing these meals to people, and I'm like welling up with tears
Yeah.
watching this. And I feel like you would probably have a similar experience if you haven't watched. That's highly recommend that you do.
I watched during the pandemic. I watched Masterclass. I took some masterclasses from like Thomas Keller and Gordon Ramsay,
yeah.
Massimo Bottura, Wolfgang Puck, and I learned so much from Thomas Keller, man. Like, because he's such an incredible teacher. There are people who are entertainers, and there are people who are really good teachers. And Thomas is definitely an incredible teacher and cook. And I've been to one of his restaurants in Napa. Oh my God, it's the best meal I've had in the States ever.
One of the best meal I've ever had was in Napa as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yonville.
Yep.
Was it Bouchon or?
Actually, there was a private party that I went to, and this, whoever the chef was that they hired for
Michelin
for this
star chef.
It was, yeah, I wept.
Yeah.
I wept.
Yeah. When you have a meal that makes you tear up, and I've had that happen before as well.
Not had that yet.
Yeah.
It's,
I need to get out more.
It's different. It's, man. It's different. Yeah. Now there, food wise, when you watch someone create and hearing them even talk about their creation, it's the same thing. It's like, you may not understand it, but when you hear someone who's passionate about and committed, as I was talking about, like the passion behind what they're playing is what you gravitate to. You may not understand what they're playing,
right?
But you hear the intensity behind it.
Yes.
Like when I hear some friends of mine talk about sports, I don't follow sports. I'm horrible with it. But when I hear them talk about it, it's like, I don't understand anything you're saying, but I'm like feeling all of this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or hearing, just when you hear someone passionately talking about something,
right?
That connectivity, that energy that they're exuding.
It's very pertinent. Yeah.
So with cooking, that's definitely kind of where I get excited, you know.
Right.
I mean, obviously talking about music, but, you know, food. Because food is more quantifiable than music. Mm. It's not as subjective. I mean, food, because you need to eat, period.
Right.
You know, if you don't like it, still, you got to eat it. Because you don't have anything else to eat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Runny yolk eggs, I can't do. Like, I've tried several times in my life.
Yeah.
It gags me every time. But I can do carbonara. But if you give me eggs Benedict, cut it open and it's oozing out, it looks incredible to me, but I can't.
Yeah.
Mm.
I can't do it. But I love escargot. I love raw oysters.
Mm.
I love beef carpaccio. I love steak tartare. Endive or endive is, depending on where you come from, is this very bitter green. Beets, okra, like all the foods that people kind of go, you know,
yeah.
I love, you know, but there are certain things for sure that I can't quite do yet. Like, I haven't done sea urchin yet. Not yet.
I'm scared to try it. Not
yet. You know, it's just one of those things where, like music, there is some subjectivity there. Some people like things simple. Scrambled eggs.
That's me.
You know what I mean? But like, when you get into the world of scrambling eggs, there's different levels of like, how do you like it coagulated? Like, do you like it like...
Do you like it more wet? You know,
more wet, or like, do you like it more fine, almost like grits? Mm-hmm.
And all the seasoning options, of course.
Seasoning options, yeah. I mean, but like, just a texture. Do you like it rubbery? Yep. You know, yeah. Do you like the big coagulation, like the big chunks, or do you like smaller? So it's like all those layers. Yeah. And everything with cooking, though, that's so cool is it's all about technique. Your taste is your taste, period. Yeah. You like a lot of salt, you put more salt in it, you know, but the technique of how you get to making that bread or that sauce or that creme brulee, whatever it is, you know the technique of how to achieve what your palate desires.
Right.
Music technique gives you longevity. Mm-hmm. Bad technique, rotator cuff mm-hmm. issues, knee issues with like how you're situated, back issues. Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of where technique comes in. But like you see somebody play traditional fast, match grip fast, yeah. pinkies off the stick fast, you know, it's like, or feet heel up, heel down, yeah. like technique. I mean, are you getting the sound that you want?
Right, right.
You know, it's not as rooted. It's not a chemistry-based outcome. Yeah, like right. food is chemistry, science-based. You know, if you have right. moisture on a steak, you try to sear it, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
That's wow. bad technique. You have to like dry the steak and then sear it, and you get that nice crust on it. Burgers, same thing. If you add something like shortening or bacon fat to the ground beef, cold, then cook it, that bacon fat comes out and it makes that nice crunch on the burger that you get. So, I mean, it's like these little things that you learn, those are technique things to achieve, like, man, how come I can get my burger to taste like this? Like, you can cook, you can follow directions.
Yeah.
You know, read the directions, watch a video, look at the technique, look at how they're cutting, and don't be afraid. I mean, it's all about patience. And that's the thing about cooking that people shy away from is the patience. Mm. It's a lot of patience doing something as simple as mise en place, like getting everything ready before you turn the eye on, have all your ingredients laid out first. And that takes time, you know, but the outcome, you will like the outcome way more than if you were just like eyeballing, like, let me just get the seasoning down, let me try a little bit of this and let me try this, you know, just grabbing stuff, not thinking it through. Then you won't remember how to get back to what you just did the next time you want to create it. So it's, I mean, it's like I said, it can be cumbersome at first, but the outcome will outweigh the work.
I love this whole conversation, the parallels of cooking and drumming. Like even you just described me like how to, you know, cook a burger. Like that whole time I was thinking of like, okay, well, you know, how to play the scenario better, like having that patience. And even like,
yeah.
You said like having the, you know, prepping the kitchen, like prepping the drum set.
Sure.
Making sure that it's ergonomically set up yep. correctly and then
tuned.
Man, it's so cool. Yeah, just there's so many parallels. I find that fascinating.
Keeping your knife sharp, keeping a good pair of sticks, you know.
yeah.
It's like you don't wanna go to play the ride somewhere with a chipped tip on a chips, you know what I mean? Like yeah. soft sounding tip on a ride. You want that knife to be sharp.
Yeah.
You know, so every time you pull it out, hone it. And then start cutting, you know, makes everything easier. Yeah. So that's all.
One more related question.
Absolutely.
Just to give a shout out back to Wine Down Nashville. Of
course, yeah.
Donaldson's only, probably Nashville's only music themed wine bar.
Yep.
If you haven't checked them out, definitely do so. But so with wine, is that also a passion? Do you normally pair wine with the meals?
Or? I don't pair wine. I just really love wine.
Okay.
Really love wine. I'm going to go buy some when I leave here.
Cool.
Where do you usually go?
The place I've been going the most has been Total Wines in Brentwood because they have the biggest selection. One of my favorite places to buy curated wines is Woodland. Is that what it's called? It's right across the street from Five Points in East Nashville. They always get like very obscure wines that you're not really going to find at typical places.
That's cool. Interesting.
And so and they know what they're getting. It's really cool. Like French and Italian wines are kind of where I gravitate to the most. If I do domestic wine, it's usually Napa wines because I don't like sweet wines, you know, blends and stuff. And like certain wines have a metallic taste to it that I don't like.
Sweet. Fantastic.
Cool, man.
Love it.
Well, yeah, do you want to just quickly plug your socials, website, where people
can go with you? Yeah, so you can find me at Stixfinnie, Stixfinnie, Instagram. You can go to my website as well. It has all of the links on there. MarcusFinnie.com, Apple Music, Spotify, Bandcamp, all that stuff. Yeah, so.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for having
me.
Man.
Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time.
Absolutely. So go home and eat some spaghetti.
Yeah, I'm going to tell me how that sauce turns out.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Nashville Drummers Podcast. If you liked it, please consider leaving us a review on the Apple Podcast app.
Also, check out our new website, NashvilleDrummersPodcast.com. And if you're not already following us on Instagram, you can follow us at Nashville Drummers Podcast.